So once, what I generally do is try to have a woman alter their styling pattern, lighten their hair, change the part, and try to do as much as they can to redistribute their existing hair. If that's not possible, or they've lost more hair, then what we really need to do is to make a decision whether redistributing their hair is going to give them a cosmetic improvement. And basically, it comes down to two different situations. In the first, a woman has a relatively stable back and sides, so they do actually have a donor area that's more stable and more dense than the front and top. So essentially, they have a pattern that's similar to a man's. So in those cases, transplantation in women is very, very effective. We basically take hair from the back and sides, we put it in the front and the top, and voila, the transplant works. The only caveats with that is that if the donor hair is not stable over time, the transplanted hair will continue to thin because it obviously is no better from where it came from. The other issue in women is that we're usually transplanting into an area that's thin but not totally bald, so that there is a little bit greater risk of having some shedding during the surgery, and that shedding, if it's miniaturized hair, may be permanent. So it's important to let women know that one procedure is often not going to be enough. It usually requires two procedures, particularly if we're transplanting into an area that has some hair already. Then the other situation is where a woman really has diffuse hair loss, and they're really not good candidates for surgery, but they have very specific needs. So for example, they may have a hair piece and want to just have a hairline done, or they have hair loss all over, but they have marked thinning at the hairline. So if we just reinforce the first inch, many times they can have the appearance of having a full head of hair. When you put those two populations of people together, the incidence of having women be good candidates is much, much smaller than with men. Can we just stop? Just hold on 1 second. Just stop it a second. So once we decide that a woman is an appropriate candidate, then the actual design of the transplant is actually significantly different than in men. And the reason is that most women need the entire hairline and temples restored. So where it's uncommon to restore temples in men, a woman really needs a much tighter frame to their face. And right. So not only do we transplant the frontal hairline, but we almost always go down the sides, the sideburn area. Another thing that I think is sometimes not realized is that many women have hair loss from brow lifts and facials, and that, facelifts. And so we often use hair transplantation to either fix the scars or to restore the density in areas of thinning from a brow lift. Right. And we can also restore the temples and get rid of the facelift scars around the ears.
Okay. What about in the case of alopecia areata?
Well, alopecia areata is a very interesting condition. It's first of all, it's an autoimmune condition where the body actually, you know, fights off its own hair follicles. It forms an inflammatory infiltrate to hairs. And in contrast to hair transplant, where hair transplant is what we call donor dominant, where the genetics of hair loss is in the follicle. So if you take healthy follicles from the back and sides and transplant them to the bald area in the top and the scalp, those healthy genes essentially are transplanted with the graft. In alopecia areata, it's recipient dominant. So essentially the condition is in the skin rather than in the follicle. So if you take healthy hair and put it into an area that has hair loss of alopecia areata, one would expect that the disease process would affect the transplanted hair. So for that reason, we're very, very cautious about transplanting people with alopecia areata. Now the reason why I say cautious but not never is because sometimes people have a single episode of alopecia areata and have just a couple of localized bald patches that occur once, and then for years and years they have no new lesions. In those cases, it might be appropriate to consider transplanting, but I usually try to wait 2 to 5 years after an episode, as long as the person has just one single episode. The risk with alopecia areata is that obviously if you do all the surgery and then their hair falls out, not only is it wasted, but the scar can become visible. And so you really want to be very, very conservative and cautious in transplanting people with alopecia areata.
Is the same true for alopecia caused by types of folliculitis and cicatricial alopecia?
Right. Well, cicatricial alopecia, is scarring alopecia, which has a really wide variety of causes. The most common one is called pseudopelade of Brock, which is a central scarring hair loss where people have this kind of scarred, bald area in the front and top of the scalp. And yes, in that condition, it's really a recipient-dominant condition. It's in the disease is in the recipient area, the area where we want to put the hair. So the hair that's transplanted would not grow. And same is with lupus, scarring alopecia from lupus and lichen planus. So all those conditions, it's not a good idea to do a transplant. And if it turns out that the condition is burnt out or old, because sometimes people can have, for example, an episode of discoid lupus and then it doesn't recur, you might want to just do a very, very, very conservative transplant and see if it grows. But in general, the transplantation is not successful in those conditions.
What if say, lichen planus or lichen planopilaris is not localized to the scalp, but, say, somewhere else on the body, like the legs or the arms? Does that give you pause to give someone a hair transplant that has that condition, yet it's not affecting their scalp?
That's a great question. From my experience, lichen planus of the body and lichen planopilaris of the scalp are usually distinct clinical conditions. So even though the diseases are the same, usually people, if they present with lichen planus on the body, don't often get it in the scalp. So in that case, I would feel comfortable in transplanting somebody. Again, you have to be cautious, but I think if they have no scalp lesions at all, I probably would be comfortable. So, again, I assume you're talking about that they have genetic hair loss and lichen planus on the body. Yeah, I think that would be okay. I wouldn't have any problem with that. The other thing I just want to mention is that when you have scarring due to things like burns or trauma, those do exceptionally well with hair transplantation. So you can't overwhelm the area at once with grafts. In other words, when you have scar, it usually has a lower vascular, lower blood supply than surrounding tissue. So you have to do the transplantation in a stepwise manner. But if you do that, the scar can be completely filled in with hair. And what you do is you put grafts in the margins or the periphery of the scar. And then those grafts, since you're living, kind of pull the blood supply in from the surrounding area, and then you just keep on going in smaller and smaller concentric circles, and you can get that whole area filled in with tissue. And not only does the blood supply come back and the hair grows, but because you're transplanting skin, you can often thicken a thin, or what we call atrophic scar, so that it can approach more closely normal tissue. So that's a very, very a good cosmetically elegant procedure.
Okay, that's actually very, very interesting. Okay. Tell us a little bit about your own practice now. I know you're located in New York. Do you have any other offices?
Well,
tell us about the services as well, consultations. How does a person sort of get treated from the moment they walk in to the when the surgery is completed?
Sure. Well, the name of my company is Bernstein Medical. And our main office is in Manhattan, and we have another office in Fort Lee, New Jersey. And I think that really what I'm noted for is I do all the consultations myself, so that I think that in some practices, especially busy ones, there are a salesman or an interface between the doctor and the patient. In our practice, I see all patients from start to finish, and people that come into our practice, I really don't view them as coming in for hair transplants, but really coming in to solve their problems for hair loss. And so we do a thorough evaluation of every patient. Many patients are not candidates for surgery, so we'll either treat them with medication or triage them if they need other types of treatment. And you know, if they do need surgery, then you know we're the world's experts in follicular unit transplantation, and we have a team that's been with me since we've developed the procedure in the mid 1990s, and we work together as a great unit. It's the follicular transplantation where you're transplanting thousands of grafts is a team approach, and we obsess about every single detail in this procedure.
That's good to know. It's good to know that, I mean, like you said, a lot of places do put a salesman in front of people. And I think that, you know, that approach that you take creates a lot of comfort for people.
Right. I think too many clinics now, because of just the nature of hair transplantation, are really kind of screen out patients for to see who are good candidates for surgery. And I think a medical practice shouldn't be like that. I think, you know, we're really taking care of people, and it's not... you know, surgery or medicine, but trying to do what's best for that particular person. And a lot of people just need hand-holding. They don't need any treatment at all. You know, sometimes people are concerned about perceived hair loss, and they may not even have any. You know, so and then especially in women, sometimes the hair loss is not genetic. It may be due to medical problems, and it's really important to, you know, give the person direction so those things can be taken care of. And that's something that really a physician really needs to have judgment in doing. You know, I'm fortunate to have a background in dermatology, so I think it gives me a little greater insight into the different kinds of hair loss. So, you know, everything is not a hammer and a nail. I think many people that present with hair loss don't simply have androgenetic alopecia, and we see that commonly in our practice.
Right. Well, I'm sure that having that degree in dermatology is a benefit to your patients, certainly. Are there a lot of hair transplant doctors that or surgeons that do not have a dermatology degree, or do you find that most of them do? Is that a common thing? I guess I've never really delved into that matter.
Well, I think, you know, people don't really, you know, think about it that much, but, you know, hair transplantation was developed by Norman Ornstreich, who is a dermatologist. So it really sits in the realm of dermatology. It only about 25-30% of people performing hair transplants in the United States, though, are dermatologists.
Okay.
And so, dermatologists have the most training in diagnosing and treating hair loss. That said, there are many hair transplant doctors that are excellent, that are plastic surgeons,
right.
And have other backgrounds. And I think that if a doctor is serious in doing transplantation, certainly these are skills that can be learned. But having the broad understanding of diseases of hair really requires an academic training.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Bernstein. This was an extremely informative interview, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to have a lot of their questions answered from this. And we thank you for the level of detail that you've taken in explaining the process, and hope we'll be able to talk to you sometime soon.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I really enjoyed speaking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.